Hi, and welcome to the Provider Podcast by NHS Providers. My name's Adam Brimelow, and in this episode, we're looking at two huge topics for the NHS and for wider society. The move to end coronavirus restrictions as part of the government's Living with COVID plans, and the role of the health service in reducing carbon emissions. We'll be examining the NHS's commitment to get to net zero by 2040, talking to an author of NHS Providers' recent report on environmental sustainability, Toby Lewis, and hearing directly from trusts that are making real headway on this vital challenge. You can join in the conversation by following us on Twitter and LinkedIn at NHS Providers with the hashtag The Provider Podcast, and keep up to date on future episodes by subscribing to the podcast. But first, living with COVID, and the government's published its plan to end all COVID restrictions on April the 1st, completing what the Prime Minister called a transition back to normality with Omicron in retreat. So from this week in England, there's no more legal requirement for people who test positive to self-isolate, though they'll still be advised to avoid contact with others for at least 5 full days. Self-isolation support payments for people on low incomes will stop. From April, there'll be an end to free universal symptomatic and asymptomatic testing, though older people and those who are vulnerable will continue to be given COVID tests, as will social care staff. A welcome step to freedom or ill-timed complacency. I'm joined by NHS Providers Deputy Chief Executive Saffron Cordery. Saffron, everyone wants to see a return to normality, but the risks around COVID haven't gone away, have they?
Absolutely not. And whilst we know that the vast majority of people who will catch COVID will recover, we do know that it still can be fatal for many people, particularly if they're vulnerable. So yes, COVID is still out there. It's still causing pressures on the array of services that health trusts provide.
And in terms of NHS provider staff, we've always urged the government to err on the side of caution. But unlike some other health organisations, we've never tried to tell it what it must do. Why have we taken that approach?
We've taken that approach because government alone is in possession of all of the facts and the data and the scientific evidence to make those decisions. And it crucially has a really important balancing role to strike between what the country needs economically, what it needs in terms of health, and what it needs in terms of its overall well-being. So that's why we've always said the government must make this decision.
Looking at the whole array of factors that can be influenced by the decision, one that's a particular cause of concern to us is health inequalities, isn't it? So why is that such a concern?
We know that the ending of free testing could impact particular groups. You know, older people who are on lower incomes, and often they come with other conditions that mean that they will want to test more frequently because they're particularly vulnerable.
So as things progress, obviously we know that COVID-19 is very unpredictable. Presumably there's got to be ongoing vigilance to be able to respond to whatever may turn up next.
Absolutely. We need to be really clear that we are alert to new variants, that we are alert to, you know, the spread of viruses in the way that we have been to date. Because what we do know is that once a new variant takes hold, the health service has to turn on a sixpence and respond to that. And it's already in a very pressured situation.
So alongside the development on restrictions, we've also had the announcement of a further vaccination booster campaign for the most vulnerable people, as if trusts didn't already have enough to be getting on with.
Absolutely. I think the booster is welcome in that we do want to carry on protecting the most vulnerable. But we also need to be clear that at the moment, trusts are dealing with a number of patients still with COVID as inpatients. We know that there are huge pressures in terms of recovering the care backlog. We know that there are huge pressures in terms of overall demand for services. And finally, we know that there are some real challenges across local systems, including with social care, that impact on trust's ability to meet need and demand. So it's not like they don't have enough on.
Saffron, thank you.
Thank you.
So climate change is a public health emergency. The NHS is rising to the challenge ahead of a report from NHS providers, which assesses the importance of the health service in steps to combat climate change, the scale of that ambition and progress to date. It also includes a range of case studies showing how some trusts are prioritising and making progress towards net zero and other environmental sustainability measures. So we'll hear from two of these in a moment. But first, Toby Lewis, who's a specialist advisor here at NHS Providers and helped put together this report. Toby, first of all, a few facts. What is the NHS's carbon footprint and what are the targets that have been set?
Well, the NHS contributes about 4% of the country's carbon footprint. And when the Lancet reviewed the actual output and the figures last year, they concluded that that amounts to about 25 megatons equivalent of carbon dioxide. Now, the NHS led the way on trying to tackle this, as you've said. There's 14 countries who've now set targets to be net zero by 2050. That was at COP26. The NHS wants to go a bit faster than that. So there's two NHS targets: direct emission related activities to net zero by 2040, and influenceable spend to net zero by 2045. And that second one's really important because about 62% of the NHS's carbon footprint actually relates to supplier activities, whether that's medicines or food or purchasing, that sort of thing.
So we know that, of course, the NHS has been under incredible pressure, hasn't it, during the pandemic, and that's not gone away. And then there's backlog recovery, investing in the workforce, taking forward the use of digital technologies. There are so many priorities that NHS leaders are having to contend with. Do trust leaders really have the headspace for the green agenda?
Well, the good news is that when NHS providers surveyed trust leaders, 78% of those coming back to us said that not only was climate change a priority, but it was a priority for 2022. The less good news, as you imply, is about 60% said they got bandwidth concerns about being able to get this done and stack it up against all the other things that we need to do. I guess two quick points, really. One, in a sense, if we make this part of the day-to-day agenda, so it's part of risk management, it's part of cost management, it's part of service transformation, then it's not that extra thing that falls off the list. And I guess the other thing, yeah, we've all lived through the last two and a half years with coronavirus. Yet some of that, I don't want to anticipate the inquiry that's coming, is about maybe under-preparing for future threat and future risk. And really what the climate emergency is about is learning that COVID lesson and preparing now for what we know is going to happen.
And as we've seen from the report that you've worked on, there's a body of evidence growing of activities that trusts have been engaging with. And you've come up with some of the enablers and barriers to progress. Let's start with two or three of the key enablers that really make a difference.
Yeah, well, there's an awful lot of NHS organisations doing an awful lot of good work in this space, whether that's about net zero mitigation or climate adaptation now. I think there's a couple I'd pick out. The first one is employee engagement, passion, activism is absolutely crucial to this issue. So we know that well over 90% of NHS employees want this to be on the leadership agenda and are actively prepared to put their shoulder to the wheel in making it happen. And we know that people who are thinking about their careers and their next steps now are interested in the moral compass of their employer. So employee participation, employee enthusiasm, tapping into that is definitely an enabler. The other one really is cross-organizational leadership. And I think this is the big thing with the report, is to migrate this subject from being the preserve of a particular individual or an enthusiast or an expert to being the business of the whole board. And that then enables this to be linked to other agendas. So you've got somewhere like Milton Keynes, where Joe Harrison has very explicitly, with his leadership team, made the connection between digital transformation and climate sustainability. So that cross-organizational leadership that taps into the enthusiasm of employees for this agenda in people's daily lives, absolutely critical. Remember, 10% of that carbon footprint for the NHS comes from employee travel. So there is a real importance to carrying the workforce with us on this agenda.
Okay, and so in terms of things that are getting in the way of progress, what are the sort of barriers that you've identified?
Yeah, I think there's a couple. The big one really is this expertise space. So on the one hand, I've said it needs to be a whole organisational leadership agenda, and that's what was in our report. On the other hand, you do need knowledge, not just knowledge about what to do, but actually knowledge about what questions to ask if you're going to govern this agenda. I guess it's a bit like digital back in the day when, you know, it was led by somebody who was IT interested and the rest of the board sort of sat by and watched it happen. So there's definitely an expertise gap that is being plugged by NHS England, but also we need to bring commerce and commercial expertise closer to the heart of this agenda. The second one is money, and I don't really mean there isn't enough of it. I mean more how you sculpt the money. So this is an upfront agenda for return on investment. So what you can't have is capital spread over multiple years, endless business cases taking an eternity. If you're going to get to net zero with rapidity, and that's what the planet requires, that's what the country requires, then you really do need to make sure that as you change the capital regime of the NHS, you don't get gunked up in committees and people can still make rapid fire capital decisions for the long term. Those are the two barriers that really came through strongly from being out in the field and talking to people.
Thanks, Toby. So let's hear from a couple of trusts that are already walking the walk on their commitment to net zero, starting with University College London Hospitals NHS Foundation Trust, which has committed to reduce its impact on the environment with a 10-point plan to reach net zero by 2031. The Trust Director of Innovation, Luke O'Shea, explained to me why they decided to take this approach.
We started having conversations with staff in the Trust who feel incredibly passionate about it, and we started looking at the data, and it was very obvious when we look at the kind of global carbon budget that if we carry on doing what we're doing, we will be using up our CO2 budget within maybe 10 or 11 years. That will take us to a sort of 2-degree increase, and it felt a little bit like we were having a conversation where we have sort of 10 years to save the earth and we're not being anywhere near radical enough. So it flowed from that we needed to be absolutely explicit of getting to net zero within 10 years and bringing, hopefully, not just our staff, but bringing, you know, other NHS organisations and other health systems around the world, hopefully, with us on that journey. So that was why we decided to declare a climate emergency and a clear target about getting to net zero.
Yeah, you mentioned declaring a climate emergency. So some people might question the value of a trust declaring a climate emergency as being a little bit tokenistic.
Yeah, we had that debate, and it was very interesting. We had that debate at the board level, and we wondered whether people would think this was, you know, a kind of declaration without substance or possibly greenwashing. But we were absolutely clear at that point. We had some major things that we could deliver that would help us to get there. And we invested over £2 million in the programme to kind of kick things off. And that included big investments in energy saving measures, vert appointments, anaesthesia. Those three were the big ones that we said, OK, we'll invest in that now alongside that commitment. But I absolutely felt, and the board were completely with us on this, that if we don't set ourselves a target, if we don't prioritise this, then we won't necessarily give ourselves the sort of push to do it. And what was wonderful was that if you do set that kind of motivates other staff. And it's a sort of virtuous circle when you do go ahead and declare a climate emergency and a target. And so actually it proved to be a really, really positive experience backed by real change.
You mentioned those three areas. One aspect that I hadn't been familiar with before was the carbon footprint of anaesthetic gas. But that's an area where you've made an early significant win.
Yeah, it's really interesting. I had absolutely no idea. And it's actually a junior doctor who came to me and said, look, Luke, do you realise that, you know, we're probably about 5% of our footprint as a big acute is anaesthetic gases? And we had a look at it, and actually we got a report from a company called Carbon Architecture, and they said that if you can reduce desflurane by 90%, you probably reduce, you know, a big chunk of that 5% by about 2/3. And we were like, wow, this is really significant. We talked to our anaesthetists, and they thought that they could, in fact, see a path where we could quite quickly reduce desflurane use and switch it to particularly sevoflurane, isoflurane. But also they said, well, you know, we ought to be doing much more intravenous anaesthesia. That is even lower footprint without gas released into the atmosphere. And we could really make some very quick changes that would deliver big benefits over a period of time. So that's what we did. I asked them what they needed. They said to deliver IV anaesthesia, we don't have enough pumps in theatres. So we bought 138 pumps. We supported them. All the anaesthetists and the support staff did an amazing job of selling this to others. They took out the desflurane out of the anaesthetic machines. The idea was to make the right thing to do the easy thing to do. And that delivered that sort of 90% reduction in desflurane pretty quickly. And I think, you know, it was a real eye-opener for me. And it was actually, you know, very much led by our anaesthetic department, particularly a wonderful anaesthetist called Damon Camming, who deserves special credit. And it's continued to be an area of focus. There's lots more to do on that. This is not at all done. But it was an area that anyone can do. And I frankly don't know why across the whole of the NHS and indeed across the whole of the globe, we don't move very quickly to end desflurane use as a very simple first step.
Yeah, and you've mentioned other measures like virtual appointments and looking at your lighting. But are there other examples of where you're seeing sort of staff-led initiatives and this whole movement gathering momentum with staff coming up with ideas to help move you towards your target?
Yeah, I mean, that's the really exciting thing. There are so many areas, but you have to keep continually communicating and empowering staff to get on with it and talking to them and say, yep, go for it. A couple of really recent examples, some wonderful staff who said, why don't we switch our search engine to a default carbon negative search engine, Ecosia, which we did last week. That means that, you know, last week we planted 600 trees as a result of just the number of searches done on our trust computers. That was very much led by our bottom-up initiative by our staff, a simple change that could be made. I could give you probably a dozen ones of those. Pharmacists who saw that we were putting unnecessary clear plastic bags in our inpatient drug distribution system, and they just decided to find a system to cut it. And again, as a brilliant pharmacist, Evie, who just said, right, here's the method, get the SOP. Then they rolled it out across the trust. There are so many of those. If you empower people to get on and see an opportunity and support that to happen, yeah, absolutely, that is going to be a huge part of where the heavy lifting will be done, is that the staff that care about this, it's their number one issue, they will go the extra mile to make it happen. So yeah, that's amazing when that happens. It's wonderful.
And what happens next?
So we are in the process of engaging a lot of staff in a much more detailed strategy with absolutely clear plans to get to our net zero ambition. The 10-point plan that we've outlined will take us a significant part of the way, but we need to look at that sort of final piece. It includes quite detailed things like understanding how do we as a trust get off gas as a major part of our carbon footprint, the capital investment that will be needed to do that kind of thing. But we hope that in that strategy that we will have a really credible, clear plan that other trusts can use as a blueprint, and that we will know the real resource implications, what's required to get to the point that we need to get in 10 years. So that's a big part of what we're doing. And as I've said, you know, trying to get staff involved in making changes themselves is a big part of it. So yeah, lots of exciting things coming on, but we want to be the first trust to have an absolutely credible strategy of how to get to net zero. And I think that's a really difficult but exciting thing to be working on.
Luke O'Shea from UCLH. On now to Kent Community NHS Foundation Trust, which provides care in a range of settings, including nursing homes, health clinics, community hospitals, minor injuries units and mobile units. It's one of the largest community health trusts in England. The Director of Corporate Services, Natalie Davis, told me how they set about reducing their carbon footprint across a big geographic area.
Well, there's lots of challenges, but there's also a huge opportunity then to do good over a vast patch. I think the things that we've learned about is that it can't just be, well, the trust itself will set the culture and the strategy. The delivery of that has to be literally grown from the ground up, and in some cases, absolutely literally, where people in their different areas find out the ways that that works for them in their buildings, be them community hospitals, be that clinics, be that clinics inside of towns and cities or out in the rural, or indeed now with people working from home, how that sustainability strategy can translate into what they do. So it's around setting the culture centrally and then making sure that everybody is signed up and aware and supported to see how it works for them.
And you mentioned that it actually literally sometimes means growing from the ground upwards. What do you mean by that?
Well, for example, we've got at Hawkhurst Community Hospital, we've got a really enthusiastic kitchen there who are looking at a kitchen garden, and they've had real success in growing their own food. So from a carbon reducing point of view, obviously that reduces mileage for that. It also means that a lot of the food is organic. But there's so many other benefits as well, which I think is where the sustainability, environmental sustainability, have this huge impact around patient therapeutic value. So we've got some patients who'll say, I used to grow tomatoes in my allotment, haven't been able to do that. Now I can because I've got, you know, the garden in the kitchen. So I think where you get the huge positive impact for some of these things is when the initiative is right for that area. And then that's being rolled out. So in Tunbridge Cottage Hospital, we're looking at a therapeutic garden because that's more the passion of the people there for how green space really impact on health and well-being. Because this isn't just about reducing carbon. This is around improving health, which is a different thing. And obviously the long-term impact.
One thing you're doing that strikes me is that I noticed you're looking to own more of your sites rather than rent them. How does that feed through into your carbon footprint?
I think if you've got a real direct control over your buildings, it means that you are able to just do things more quickly. We know in the NHS, some of these things that you know are what we call no-brainers, you know, really easy to do and really beneficial. You own the buildings, you can just get on and do it because the staff are there and supporting it and the population without having to go through. And it also means when you own your building, you can know it in a way that is to a much greater level. So for the buildings that we've now owned, we're doing the decarbon surveys, we're doing, you know, smart meters, the use of exactly how hot all the rooms are and in all the roof crevices and all those things that you wouldn't usually get access to if you didn't own it. So it just gives you firstly access to all areas and then just cutting down the bureaucracy of getting things done.
It's interesting you mentioned the sort of very close monitoring of what you're doing, and I know that you're paying very close attention to data in terms of the way you manage your interventions, for example, in terms of sort of mileage and this sort of thing. Yeah. How important is that in terms of not just monitoring your progress, but also holding yourselves accountable to the aspirations you have?
It is so important. I think Dan Wright, our head of sustainability, you know, he'll always say you can't manage what you can't measure and you don't know what works. And I think particularly with this agenda that is so huge and so important, you really got to focus in on what are the things that are going to turn the dial. So for us as a community trust, our grey fleet, our staff's own cars that are used on journeys and commuting and all of that, that's a huge, huge impact to us. So Dan's developed a tool that can really look at where that mileage goes and the use of carbon in that, you know, the electrical vehicles versus hybrid vehicles versus petrol and diesel, to map that through. And once you understand that, then you can introduce initiatives that we're looking at, like pool cars, electric pool cars, like bikes, bicycle changing facilities with showers, you know, these clubs to those areas. But until you know that data, you can't work out what is going to be the most effective thing. And as a subset of that, we've also found that actually some claims going in, it helps to understand the data better because some claims going in are against registration numbers that don't exist anymore. So you do the right thing, and there's all these other benefits that will come out of projects, which is quite exciting.
So Toby, there's clearly a real commitment and desire to get to net zero. When you look across the range of case studies and your other research in this area, what are the key recommendations for trusts and for systems and for national leaders?
So the key recommendations for national leaders are to make sure we get to a standardized reporting arrangement so that we know how we're doing. That's so important. And at the moment, people are reporting in different ways, and that gets in the way of what ought to be a race to be first, not a race to be near the back. National leaders need to make sure the capital flow keeps flowing. And there may be a case for a little bit of assistance, particularly in the PFI space, where there is some evidence that it's more difficult for investors to kind of get cracking and get estate adaptation sorted out. But the big leadership agenda here is a local one. So there are really three key things. The first is to make this part of the ICB, part of the ICS, part of the ICP, actually, from the get-go. Systems are looking for a role. This is a system leadership role. Secondly, when thinking about one's green plan, let's think about, have I got the expertise to deliver on this? And if not, how do I borrow it from the NHS organisation next door? How do I share it with local GPs? How do I buy it in? And the final thing is focus, focus, focus on supply chain. And that may fit very neatly, you know, with a localization agenda around anchoring, around economic and social value, which is in the bill going through Parliament. So have a real look at your supply chain. And now is the time after COP26 to be really challenging with your suppliers about what they're truly contributing to this agenda.
That's it. My thanks to Toby Lewis, Natalie Davis, Luke O'Shea, and of course to Saffron Cordery. Remember, you can join in the conversation by following us on Twitter and LinkedIn at NHS Providers with the hashtag The Provider Podcast, and keep up to date on future episodes by subscribing to the podcast. Thank you.